Mitch CV mushes under the burled arch in Nome to win the 2017 Iditarod. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, two Anchorage Democrats introduce a bill to create a climate change commission, but questions remain over whether it will actually pass.
What might be politically acceptable within the current makeup of the legislature?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
Mitch CV has won the 2017 Iditarod. He crossed the finish line in Nome at 3:40 this afternoon. At 57, CV is the oldest musher to win, and his runtime set a new course record. Trail reporter Ben Matheson joins us live from Front Street in Nome. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lori.
So what's the scene there on Front Street right now?
Front Street is empty at the moment. Mitch CV came off after his victory, came into the Mini Convention Center and took questions for about an hour and really kind of soaked up his record-setting victory. But the crowds will come back after just a bit as the second and third mushers, Dallas Beattie and Nick Petit, will be the next ones to come in.
All right, and we're having a little bit of a hard time hearing you, Ben, but have you had a chance to talk to Mitch? What did he have to say about beating his son and being the oldest musher to win?
I think Mitch thinks that he is at the top of his career, and he really is. He had the strongest dog team that a lot of people have ever seen. He set speed records, of course, on this race. He, especially along the coast, he was able to take a lot of rest to hold off his competitors that were looking to unseat him. So he absolutely had a fast, fast run up the coast, and that's something that he's really proud of. He trains year-round. His genetics program runs year-round. He has puppy teams that run the race. So it's an operation that's been years and years in the making. He first ran this in 1982, and I think he's really satisfied that he executed the plan that he's been putting together for years.
And once again, please let us know who is likely to come in second and third. It was a little hard to hear you earlier.
We're expecting Dallas Speedy, that's the three-time defending champion, and the son of Mitch Speedy, who's battling it with Nick Petit out of Girdwood, originally from France. Those two, I believe, are traveling about a mile apart, and they left the White Mountain checkpoint earlier today, about 13 or 15 miles apart. So the race is on for second with two extremely fast and competitive dog teams.
All right. Thanks so much, Ben. Ben Matheson and Zachariah Hughes thanks a lot. Ben Matheson and Zachariah Hughes have been covering the race for Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. You can catch more news, interviews, and all things mushers and dogs in the Iditapod podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or alaskapublic.org. The state Senate is looking to make up to $300 million in cuts to the state budget, but the Senate subcommittees looking to trim state agencies' budgets are finding much smaller cuts. The subcommittees plan to finish their work today. The biggest recommended cuts were to the Department of Health and Social Services, which saw a $55 million cut, and the University of Alaska, whose budget was cut by $16 million. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says it was difficult to make the health and social services reductions.
It was certainly easier a couple of years ago when perhaps there was some fat. I think we're past those days. We don't have the perpetual benefit of continued cuts. At some point, there will be someone that is going without a constitutionally required service.
Kodiak Republican Senator Gary Stevens says of the university budget cut that Alaskans may not understand the effect of the cuts.
I hate to see this happen, but I think the problem is the public is not just not aware of the horrible situation we are in. And although all of these budget cuts are painful and we're sorry to see them happen, we just have got to get the public awareness out there that we have a serious problem and then an inclination in the public to do something about it.
Anchorage Democrat Senator Berta Gardner says cutting the university budget is unwise at a time when the state's need for a better educated workforce is large and growing. Gardner says she doesn't believe $300 million in cuts will make it into the final budget.
I don't see where it's coming from, and I think the House wouldn't tolerate it either.
The House has rejected a series of amendments proposed by the Republican Minority Caucus over the past 2 days. The House Finance Committee cut the budget by $31 million. The Senate Finance Committee will hear public testimony on the budget on Friday. Two Anchorage Democrats have introduced a bill to create a statewide commission on climate change. As Rachel Waldholz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, even its authors doubt the bill has much of a chance this session, but they argue it's a step in the right direction.
Representatives Andy Josephson and Garen Tarr have introduced climate-related bills in the past, but without much success. Then, this session, control of the State House flipped, and Josephson and Tarr went from legislative backbenchers to co-chairs of the powerful House Resources Committee, which sets the agenda on natural resource issues. But that doesn't mean climate policy is suddenly going to have an easier time in the Alaska legislature. I asked Josephson if he was confident his bill could clear the House.
Well, that's a very good question.
And that's in the chamber his caucus controls, never mind the Republican-controlled Senate, where the relevant committee chair has said there's no need for climate legislation. The bill itself is fairly modest. It would create a climate change commission with a permanent presence in the governor's office. The commission would work with the governor to develop a statewide climate strategy, potentially covering everything from relocating villages to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The commission's work would be funded with a penny per barrel tax on oil, equal to a current tax that goes to towards oil spill prevention and response efforts. Josephson estimates the tax would bring in under $2 million per year. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the costs of, say, relocating even a single community, a point Josephson readily admits.
It's not enough. You know, what we had to look at is what were sources of revenue and what might be politically acceptable within the current makeup of the legislature.
Josephson says he sees the funding as seed money, enough to get the office up and running so it can go after outside grants. For now, both Josephson and co-sponsor Tarr say their goal is simply to get the bill moving. Tarr says if not this spring, maybe it will have a shot at passing next session. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, can Ivy League students help rural Alaska with its high cost of energy?
We do a quarter of a budget for diesel. That's not sustainable.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Consider PicClick Give to Alaska Rural Veterinary Outreach when filing for your 2017 PFD. This nonprofit provides critically needed veterinary care to rural villages, including spay-neuter surgery, vaccines, basic wellness, and education to help reduce the overpopulation of unwanted pets, high rate of dog bites, and the spread of disease. Learn more at akrvo.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Rural Veterinary Outreach.
A bill to replace the Affordable Care Act is on shaky ground in Congress, drawing criticism from left, right, and center in the U.S. House. The Republican bill was the topic of discussion on Talk of Alaska today. Becky Haltberg is the CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. She was a guest on Alaska Public Media's call-in program.
One of the criticisms of the original Affordable Care Act is that it addressed coverage, but it didn't address cost. But this bill really is not addressing the cost side either. It's just rolling back some of the coverage.
The Congressional Budget Office says the bill would save the federal government billions of dollars, in part by shifting future cost increases for Medicaid to the states. Governor Bill Walker has said Alaska isn't in a position to pay more. For low and middle income Alaskans who buy policies on healthcare.gov, the generous subsidies would disappear, replaced by tax credits that are, on average, 78% less. The CBO analysis of the bill says it could result in 14 million more Americans being uninsured next year. Hultberg says having a large number of uninsured Alaskans drives up costs initially for the hospitals she represents.
Because we will see anyone in the emergency room, regardless of their ability to pay, that is both a moral imperative and a federal mandate. So when we don't have people with coverage, they will be seen in a hospital, which is not an efficient way to take care of the population.
Joshua Weinstein advises employers on health insurance options as president of North Rim Benefits Group.
Prior to the ACA, you had an individual market. We had four or five players in Alaska, but we had problems. So although the rates were lower, if you weren't healthy, you could be declined coverage.
Weinstein says Alaska's individual marketplace now has just one insurer, Premera. The cost of premiums without the subsidies are the highest in the nation. They'd be even higher, Weinstein says, if it weren't for state-supported reinsurance, sliding-scale subsidies, and other assistance in the ACA.
This sort of triple support system of the state providing lower premiums for everyone, the tax credits to lower it to be a function of your income, and then further reducing your deductible and out-of-pocket expense is what has allowed Alaska's individual insurance market to remain, and I say this sort of liberally, semi-functional.
Weinstein says the U.S. House bill would erode those pillars, destabilizing Alaska's already unstable market. He described the potential effects in Alaska as destructive and disastrous. But Weinstein says on the plus side, the Republican proposal could help businesses by removing coverage requirements.
There's the opportunity for some greater creativity and flexibility in health plans. That could potentially create more employers offering health insurance, whereas now the bar may be too high in terms of cost. There are lots of repeals of different forms of taxation that will potentially create more capital out for the entrepreneurs to go and grow and be in business.
The bill sped through two House committees last week. The next big test is Thursday when it goes before the House Budget Committee. Alaska Congressman Don Young won't have a chance to vote on it until it reaches the House floor, likely next week. He has not publicly announced how he'll vote. Late last month, the Trump administration released new instructions on how Homeland Security is supposed to implement immigration policies. Under the Obama administration, immigration officers focused on deporting people who committed serious crimes. Now, everyone who has violated immigration laws could be arrested, detained, and deported. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned these changes put some Alaskans in limbo.
Mateo and Valentine sit in their immaculate living room. The furniture, the art, the wall color, it's all perfectly coordinated, like you'd see in a magazine. A teacup-sized puppy in a pink sweater bounces around their feet and climbs up on the interpreter's lap.
They've just bought a house a few months ago, thinking that they had a life in America, but not in the United States. But now, even being here, they don't feel like the house really belongs to them.
The couple arrived with two of their children in 2005 from Latin America. I'm not using their real names or their country of origin. They have immigration documents, but they aren't permanent residents. One of their children is undocumented. Mateo says they could be considered criminals just for having a child who is undocumented living in their house.
Quisiéramos decir que esto es una pesadilla porque...
They want to think sometimes that it's a nightmare because you can wake up from a nightmare. But right now, it's just simply terrifying.
Mateo used to work as a police officer fighting drug cartels in Latin America. He was used to receiving death threats, but he says 10 years ago, they threatened to kill his oldest son. He realized the danger was real and imminent, so they fled to the United States. Valentin had to leave her oldest daughter behind with her parents. She hasn't seen her in a decade. Their immigration lawyer, Leah McDermott, says the family, like many others, are in limbo. She says up until the new orders were issued, if a person filed paperwork to try to stay in the country legally, they would be somewhat protected from being deported by the Department of Homeland Security.
In other words, DHS knows you're here, but because you're in the process of applying for a benefit, you're considered extremely low priority for removal. Well, now all the priorities are out the window. I mean, Trump has announced that basically everyone is a priority for removal.
We should expect to see more people deported who are married to American citizens and don't have criminal records. That's what I'm seeing.
That's Margaret Stock, another immigration lawyer in Anchorage. Stock says it's not like people want to be out of compliance with immigration laws. It's just really complicated.
If you want to get your paperwork here in America processed, you have to have the money and the time, and you have to have all your documents in order, and it's not easy for people to do.
For Mateo and Valentin, it was hard to live without documents their first few years in the country. Mateo says he felt like one of the criminals he used to pursue was a law enforcement officer. As soon as they had documents and social security numbers, the couple established their own businesses and started building their lives here in safety. Mateo says he's worried about how immigration laws are being enforced and what that means for his family. But he's also worried about how attitudes towards immigrants are changing. They're
not worried about the wall that Trump wants to build at the border. They're worried about the wall that is being built through hate and rejection of immigrants in the hearts and minds of people, because that's a wall that you can't see.
He says, for now, they're just living their lives as normally as possible, saving the money they plan to use to expand their house and setting it aside, just in case. But they can't go back to Latin America because it's too dangerous. They want to stay here, in their home. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Some communities in rural Alaska are desperate to stop shelling out money to power their communities on diesel. They're open to alternative energy, but most don't have the funding to even explore those ideas. Help could come in the form of graduate students from Harvard University who have been tasked with the assignment of solving some of Alaska's fossil fuel energy woes. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
Harvard Law student Mike Maruka may sound like he's describing a spring break trip.
We also got to drive out to Seward and went skiing at Alyeska. And we managed to catch the Northern Lights last night.
We did.
Sort of. They were not very clear.
But he's actually in Alaska for a class that's looking for practical solutions to reduce the use of fossil fuels, especially in low-income, underserved communities. With Alaska in a multi-billion dollar hole, state funding, including a lot of grant money, has been slashed. Maruka thinks it's time for Alaskan communities to start looking for funding outside the state.
Private money, such as from a large company or from a university, might be able to, in some cases, step in to where public funds used to support such projects.
The team's goal is writing a proposal to reduce 50,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. The value of that reduction, measured in carbon credits, could be sold to private companies looking to offset their own carbon footprints.
The innovation is here. All that we are looking into is a way that an outside player who might want to capitalize on carbon offsets might be able to fill a gap or make something happen that wouldn't otherwise occur.
By the way, Maruka says 50,000 tons of CO2 is the average total emissions for a community of 20 to 25,000 people for a year. But most communities in Alaska aren't that big, which Caroline Lauer, a student studying urban planning, says is one of the biggest challenges for the team.
The high benchmark has really forced us to be creative and figuring out how can we package a bunch of different innovative options together to maybe get as close to 50,000 as possible.
The team didn't have the chance to visit rural Alaska, but they were in Anchorage this month meeting with energy experts from across the state. One of those experts is Christopher Emmerich, the city administrator and clerk for the Aleutian community of False Pass. And he's totally on board with this project.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. Yeah, sounds like a wonderful idea.
False Pass is a 73-person community that runs on diesel, which is expensive. Emmerich says the city spends around $200,000 a year on it.
Cost of energy is paramount with these small communities for surviving into the future, especially as funding is getting cut. If they got to keep paying like we do a quarter of a budget for diesel, that's not sustainable.
Since 2012, False Pass has been looking into tidal power, which would allow the community to be less reliant on diesel and more self-sufficient. But it comes with a hefty price tag, around $7 million, and the community can't foot the bill alone. Right now, the Harvard students are just working for course credit. They don't have any real funds to invest in rural Alaska. But that doesn't faze Emmerich. He's doing everything he can to make sure False Pass's energy projects are as ready as possible, just in case any outside financing comes along. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
Mitch Seavey may be this year's Iditarod champion, but there are still a lot of people on the trail. For mushers who have been competing for a long time, there are traditions they revisit race after race. When Martin Boozer gets to Unalakleet, that means a bag of muktuk.
I love eating the local food. And for about 15 years, a little girl would come and meet me no matter what time of my arrival. Her mom would drag her down, and now the girl, of course, is grown up and out of Unalakleet.
But that tradition is being held up by someone new, who stood patiently by Boozer's dog team before handing him a Ziploc bag of whale skin and blubber.
This little boy has come and brought me muktuk. Local boy Wasuk Jones brings me muktuk every time I show up, inconveniencing himself and his family to make sure I have some of the most delicious muktuk around, so that's just always heartwarming when he shows up and brings me that. I always gobble it down right away.
As Boozer watered his dogs, he chatted with Clarence Tuarek, who has come down to say hi to the musher each year since the 80s. Tuarek explained when mushers are on the front of the pack, they don't have much time or energy for talking with folks.
At least you got a sense of humor at this point in time. There's guys in the top 5 to 10, they're all business. So.
It's not been a great race for Boozer. His dogs have been persistently sick, which at one point made him doubt he'd be able to finish. That's never occurred. In nearly 4 decades of mushing, Boozer hasn't scratched in an Iditarod. But the worst seems to be over, and he said the dogs finally look ready to run.
All I need to do is get it done. Just get to know him, get this over with. That's all I need. Get another one in the books. Regroup.
If he finishes, this will be Martin Boozer's 34th Iditarod. Closing the Bergman Hotel left some of its tenants homeless, and now they're wondering what they'll do next. The historic building has suffered from years of neglect and mistreatment. KTOO's Quinton Chandler reports some residents, including Charlie Joseph, didn't know about the Juneau closure until they were out on the streets.
Juneau officials posted a sheet of paper condemning the Bergman on its door. The paper had orders for all the tenants to be out in 24 hours. They also sent a letter to the owners and the property manager listing 15 ways the building violated city code. Joseph says no one told him about the closure, but he had heard rumors about what might happen.
But I didn't get no paper. Nobody came and talked to me about it. So everything was up in the air.
Joseph plans to spend his next night indoors. He's filling out a sign-in sheet for the warming station in the lower level of the Salvation Army Church. There are 7 people sleeping here tonight, and 4 are Bergman residents. The night before, about 15 people came for soup, and 7 spent the night. Chris Clark is playing cribbage with 2 friends. Clark says he found out the Bergman was being closed 2 hours before he had to leave.
There were 4 fire marshals standing out on the lawn. And I asked them what they were doing there, and they said, well, we're condemning the place. I paid $750. And they're not giving me that money back. I'm not only homeless, I'm homeless with AIDS, and I have no clothing, no medication, no anything. I have nothing.
He also has a bad back and is on disability.
You know, I was really proud of being able to pay for my own home. And now it's gone, and so was my money. So yeah, I'm a little upset.
Clark says he and his friends spent the day at the bus stop where they went to keep warm. He's thankful for the Salvation Army. Lieutenant Lance Walters with the Salvation Army says this warming station is on a trial run.
We're going to be open from 7 in the evening to 7 in the morning, and we're going to go till Tuesday morning.
Whether they open again depends on how many people volunteer. Walters says the station is a second chance for people who can't sleep in the glory hole. The shelter won't take people with a blood alcohol level over 0.1. Walters says the Salvation Army won't turn away drunk people unless they cause too much trouble. The city and borough of Juneau's letter to the Bergman's owners gave them a chance to fix the building and open it to tenants in the future. When each of the 15 violations are fixed, the letter says to contact the CBJ for an inspection. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Police had promised Bergman residents on Friday that city officials would let them recover their belongings still in the building. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Andrew Kitchenman and Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Zachariah Hughes in Unalakleet. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Utqiagvik March 15th and 16th at the Inupiat Heritage Center from 9 to 5. To develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence, the public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.